Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm very excited for this week's show because we are traveling all the way west. We're going to Wally World with the moosiest moose we know, JB.
Holiday Road.
And you're fired.
I'm trying to provide a bed for whatever you say. I never realized how much affection I had for that song.
It's terrific.
Oh, it's really good.
Yeah.
In fact, I have a theory about the song. Until some fucking advertising thing.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was last Christmas.
It was recently.
And proof that advertising doesn't work. I don't know what product it was for. Was it T-Mobile?
I have no idea. It doesn't matter.
And they used the song and changed the lyrics?
Yeah.
Badly?
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, don't do that to Holiday
Road. Didn't know. Obviously, we'll get into National Lampoon's Vacation, yes, which is the subject of this week's show. I did not know that that was an original composition for the movie. I thought it was like, hey, Lindsey Buckingham wrote this song and it works.
Here's my theory.
All right.
Because that Kenny Loggins song...
We're just into it. We're right into it.
...had been such an integral part of Caddyshack.
Right.
Someone creating National Lampoon's Vacation had the idea that that would help. Because I would argue that the closing credit song is equally
we
fun.
Go dancing. Hot take, Holiday Road, better than I'm All Right. Hotter take, Vacation, better than Caddyshack. Listen, everyone, we're going to get into it.
That's a controversial opinion, because there are people who...
I know.
...regard Caddyshack
I know.
As...
And they're all like these older white men who, as soon as they find out I like movies...
They will do their shitty Bill Murray impression.
They've seen three movies, and two of them are Caddyshack.
It's a Cinderella story.
And it's the best movie ever made. Anyway, hey, guess why we're talking about Vacation, J-Bones?
Why?
Because if you live near Chicago and you're listening to this today, Wednesday,
cancel
April 11th? What is 11th?
Cancel your plans for this evening.
That's right. You can come out to the Elk Grove Theater in Elk Grove, Illinois, and see Vacation on the big screen. I'm going to talk about it a little. J-Bones will be in the audience heckling me, as
yes,
always.
And throwing things. I have new items.
Which I like. The toast, I felt, was a big hit. Carried over, obviously, from Rocky Horror. But
it was left over from screening. The movie was over, and we're like, oh, there's still toast left in the bag. Let's save this.
Anyway, we are going to talk about National Lampoon's Vacation, but first, J-Bones, have you seen anything good lately?
Well, yes, because I go to the movies more than anyone.
Retired!
Except Adam Risky.
Not retired!
So I went to see the Death Wish remake.
Ooh, this is one of mine, too.
And I'll tell you how bad it is. Earlier today, no, I didn't fall asleep.
I could have.
Because of Vincent D'Onofrio. It was interesting that that part does not exist in the Charles Bronson version, nor should it.
I could argue that it doesn't exist in the Bruce Willis version.
But I like Vincent D'Onofrio so much, and I thought he did a decent job. I thought he was the only real human being in the movie.
Can I spoil Death Wish 2018? Listeners, if you plan to see Death Wish 2018... tune out for 30 seconds here.
Or don't see it.
The Roger Ebert Law of Economy of Characters suggested to me that at some point we were going to find out that Vincent D'Onofrio was responsible for what had happened to Bruce Willis's family. I wasn't looking forward to that particular development.
No.
There was one scene where I felt like, oh, that's where they're tipping this.
Well, there's certainly... I see exactly, because he's constantly needing money.
But it doesn't pan out, and then you just wonder why he's in this movie. He's not even Tommy Lee Jones in Rolling Thunder.
No, it's a different color script page that just got lost.
I wanted to hear him say, let me get my gear, and he never does, god damn it.
Here's how bad the Death Wish remake is. I think I saw it a week and a half ago, and I was looking at that master list I keep because I have the disease of what I've seen, and when I saw Death Wish on the list, I paused and I saw Death Wish. This is a week and a half ago. It's
crazy because it has existed in pre-production for so long, and Joe Carnahan had this version, and he's still the credited screenwriter on it. And I'm very interested in the Joe Carnahan version of that movie. It's like a nothing. It's like a nothing of a movie, a nothing of a remake. So much of the exposition is being handled by radio DJs and not just any radio DJ, but Mancow, who, if you live in Chicago, is the most hated of radio DJs.
The scourge of morning radio.
And to hear him pop up so often was very upsetting to me. And, then, and it was the only thing that got a reaction from me in the entire movie.
And then the film realizes that to have the only radio Greek chorus presence is this reactionary white guy. They add the black radio station.
Sway from Sirius.
You have to be fair.
At no point is Bruce Willis a different person. When he's a surgeon with a happy family, when his wife is murdered and he's a vigilante, he's literally the same guy the whole movie.
And you're more familiar with this phenomenon than I am, because you would tend to go to these types of movies more, say, his entire career for the last 10 or 15 years. But to say that he sleepwalks through this movie, it's just, you know, Bruce, you used to care.
This just came up, I think, last week, because I rewatched 16 Blocks, which is a movie from the 2000s where he's not phoning it in and he's actually really good. And he's like playing an older guy who is kind of tired and washed up, and he's really good in it. And it's a bummer to just watch no one give a shit in this movie. Even Eli Roth doesn't really lean into the kind of trashier aspects of the movie. I mean, the whole thing obviously leaves kind of a bad taste now with the culture where this movie is just about fetishizing guns and killing people. But there was something about the 70s one, at least Michael Winner and J. Lee Thompson would lean into that shit.
Yes. And I would maintain that much more than other exploitation films, both of them are aware of what they're dealing with.
Yes.
And the film has some, I don't think it's a mindless glorification of what he's doing.
The original Death Wish we're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that is, you know, kind of the best possible version of that movie. And P.S., James Wan made Death Wish 10 years ago, the Kevin Bacon movie Death Sentence. Have you ever seen it?
Yeah.
It's so much better than this Death Wish remake. This movie is unnecessary, and we will have all forgotten. It's like the Point Break remake. We're going to bring up Death Wish, and no one will ever say which one, because we're only talking about one of them.
They should have called the remake Pointless Break.
Right. When someone mentions,
take a break, you know,
you know, horror movie I love, Dawn of the Dead. Like, every once in a while, you might be like, yeah, but which one? No one is doing that with Point Break. No one is like, oh, last night I watched Point Break. Oh, yeah, that one from 2016. No. And same with Death Wish.
And then I went to see, and I was very afraid that this film's visual acuity, or I should say this film's mise-en-scene, was beyond my personal visual acuity, because I've had that experience. I went to see Ready Player One, and I thought it was delightful. I thought it was a delightful adventure film full of interesting ideas, and even though I'm not a gamer, I get what they were doing. Another amazing Mark Rylance performance. Have you seen it yet?
I have not. I'm waiting to take Charlie, and I just haven't been able to yet.
It's really, really good, and Dana Stevens, who I very much respect, brought something up on the Slate podcast that she was sick of men and boys being the gatekeepers of the imaginative world. So she really took exception to the gender roles in Ready Player One, which I thought was interesting, because there are other parts of Ready Player One that really seem to be making an effort to be inclusive.
Okay.
I don't want to give anything away
because
it would be a major spoiler. And it reminded me, Louis Anderson was on Real Time last week, and they were talking about his role on Baskets. And apparently on Baskets, he plays a woman.
Right.
And he has a new book out where it's about his relationship with his mother, and he's dressed as a woman on the cover. And Bill Maher brought up if he was getting any shit from a certain part of social media that he was taking a part away from an actual female actress. And Louis, who, whether you like his comedy or not, and I actually do, seems like just the nicest, most genuine person on earth, paused and said, but if they had hired a woman, it wouldn't be as funny. And he wasn't being Jerry Lewis, women aren't funny.
Right.
He was suggesting that he was the best choice for that part to make it as funny as it is.
Right.
And so it bothered me that we're going to get stuck in this Hall of Mirrors, but then at that point I feel like Grandpa and I tap out.
Well, a trailer for a movie, and I don't even remember the name of the movie today. I just saw something posted about it at Birth, Movies, Death. A trailer for a movie came out today. I should look it up. I'm too lazy. About a trans character, and she's played by Matt Bomer of the Magic Mike movies and White Collar fame. And the journalist who was writing about the trailer, who I believe was Lee Monson, said, hey, why not have a trans actor play this part? And that I get, I think, more than the Louis Anderson thing. And maybe that's not fair. Maybe I'm splitting hairs and making excuses. But certainly there are plenty of trans actors who could have played this part, just as somebody could have played Jared Leto's Oscar-winning role in Dallas Buyers
Club. But are we eventually going to get to the point, and I realize that I'm not the person to comment on this because my middle name is Mr. White Privilege, that if the character in the scenario has been sexually abused, do we have to hire an actor who's been sexually abused? Are we going to get to that point? Because at some point, where's the acting?
Sure, but I don't think you can equivocate those two things at all.
Why not?
Because I think you're talking about experience versus who a person is versus, you know, hiring an African American actor instead of putting C. Thomas Howell in blackface versus somebody who just has experienced something and therefore needs to be hired. I don't agree with that at all. But I think there's a point to be made. You know, if no trans people existed, then sure, gosh, we better get Matt Bomer in women's clothing.
But then why? I understand why you would want a trans person to play a trans person. Mm-hmm. I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But then why is Louis as a woman okay? Because it's a comedy?
Partially.
And the trope of men dressing as women goes back.
And because Louis Anderson is specifically playing his mother.
Yes.
And I'm not saying that.
Here's all I'm saying.
This is dangerous territory.
I think it's a slippery slope. And I'm certainly not one to comment on it. But I'm just wondering, how far do we take this? I'm all for inclusion.
I recognize that women are still underrepresented on screen. But not to the degree that actual trans people are. And so I think greater efforts need to be made right now.
No, I agree with that. And the real inequality is because someone in Hollywood has decided that men are delightful and wonderful and appealing into their 60s, and yet women have a very, very short shelf life.
Yes.
And we need to make more parts for mature women. And then today at the wonderful cinema, I saw the trailer for Book Club.
I've not seen the trailer for Book Club, but I think I know what it is.
Academy Award winner Jane Fonda, Academy Award winner Mary Steenburgen, Academy Award nominee Candice Bergen. Who's the fourth one? There's four. And they have a book club. And they decide,
Judi Dench, Helen Mirren. Doesn't matter.
It would be so cute to read 50 Shades of Grey.
Oh, that sounds funny.
And this apparently opens them all up, and they decide to have a second chance at love because apparently all four of them are single or something. And I'm just watching this, and they're hoping that there's this audience that wants to see themselves represented on screen, and maybe some people will think it's cute.
Right.
But when you look at the talent involved, you're like, so you can't make a movie about the real experience of four 60-year-old female friends and something that's not this gimmicky and, isn't it cute? They're getting frisky.
Well, sure, yes and no. We're so far afield from what we were talking about. But just before we turned the mics on, we were talking about Blockers.
Yes.
And you were saying, like, hey, why can't they make a comedy where it's not about adults acting like idiots? And I agree with that 100%. But at the same time, that is the movie that we get, whether it's Blockers or Neighbors or The Hangover or whatever, right? And yet, because it's about white people of a certain age, it's a comedy for everyone, right?
Diane Keaton is the fourth
of course she
member
is.
Of the book
how
club.
How the fuck did we not come up with that? It's the comedy for everyone, right? And no one's complaining about that. No one's saying, like, well, hey, how come you can't make the good version? I mean, we are a little bit, but we kind of give these movies a pass. And yet, when one of these slightly more niche movies comes out, we're a little hard on it. And I think in the same way that, like, last year you saw Girls Trip and you were like, oh, that movie's not funny. And I said, sure, I didn't laugh either. That movie's not for me. Book Club is not for me. And so if it is serving an audience... right on. Do I wish that a better movie would serve the same audience?
That's,
of course.
That's what I was thinking when I sat through the trailer.
But we also have to sort of take what we can get right now and keep trying to do better. And so if five book clubs come out, maybe the sixth one, somebody will say, oh, you know what? I could do that, but better, because now there's proof that this audience needs to be served because these movies are hits. So, hey, studio, why don't you give me $20 million and I'm going to make the good version of Book Club.
The sequel writes itself. It's European Book Club and they travel overseas.
And they can't understand any of the words.
And the cast is great, not just the women. Craig T. Nelson's in it. Andy Garcia's in it because each of the women needs
a
man.
Right.
Richard Dreyfuss is in it as well.
All right.
And then I went to see Isle of Dogs and ran into our own Adam Riske in the lobby.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he was there to see Isle of Dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to see Isle of Dogs. Mm-hmm. And I know I liked Isle of Dogs more than Mr. Riske, because halfway through a movie he doesn't like, Mr. Riske gets quite frisky. He was getting very antsy, I noticed. But
when
he did
say
not
frisky, he wasn't like getting handsy with you.
He did not walk out.
Okay, good.
Well, I'm not discounting that. I just didn't want to talk about that on the podcast. Isle of Dogs is charming and fine. It's good, not great. I think for the first time, Wes Anderson's frou-frou starts getting in the way. The overly...
Is it the first time?
No,
though?
No, because this is in terms of things being labeled and such. There's a whole thing with how the English is put across and how the Japanese is translated and things. It's a minor work, but it's not without its pleasures. And of course, there's a big blowback against I Love Dogs, because why does this have to take place in Japan, and is this cultural appropriation? And I'll let everyone decide for themselves. And then I saw Death of Stalin, which I did not like. It's an attempt to take real historical moments and sort of Monty Python-ize them.
And why couldn't they get real historical figures? I'm just joking. I'm making light of the conversation we were just having. See?
Oh, okay. Wow.
Listen, it's all right.
I'm just lost.
They're not all going to be great.
And it doesn't work because... it's really based on history, and it's really based on some pretty dark history. So when the Dark Knight in Monty Python's in the Holy Grail...
Batman?
No, the Black Knight. The Black Knight is invincible.
Oh, God, that's different.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Is
it's just a flesh wound.
Exactly. Okay. Is presented as this insufferable and gradually gets his limbs hacked off.
Right.
And then you have King Arthur. What are you going to do, bleed on me? I'm invincible. You're a loony. That works. It's amazing. And Gilliam has said
when
that
you're a child, it's the funniest thing you've ever seen.
Wow.
Because nothing made me laugh harder.
And Gilliam said that was the acid test. Because if you look at where that is in the film,
right,
that really shows you where it's going. Yeah. And if you're in, you're in. But... Death of Stalin is based on real history, where some real serious, awful, I don't want to spoil it, awful shit went down. And to try to make fun of it, I'm sure there's a way. This is not the way. And it's just, I thought it was a mess.
And it's getting great reviews, and I'm unfamiliar with Armando Iannucci, right? I haven't seen In the Loop. I never watched Veep. So I know that he is sort of a beloved figure with a certain style of politically minded satire. I don't know any of his work, so I'm not rushing out to see Death of Stalin.
It was odd. And then finally, this morning I saw Chappaquiddick, which I thought was excellent, a serious movie about a serious subject, and it's full of ideas. Mm-hmm. This month on HBO, they're showing a documentary about Arthur Miller by his daughter. And it's a little long, but it's really, really good because as opposed to, and then he wrote this, and then he married Marilyn Monroe, and then he wrote this, and then he died. She had such access to him and to the archives and to interviews, and she filmed a lot of stuff with him before he died, that it's full of ideas about the purpose of art and the way we choose to live our life. And so was Chappaquiddick. There were moments, I told you this before we started, there were moments of Chappaquiddick that were Shakespearean in terms of the fathers and the sons and what your responsibility is and what it's like to have a moral compass and the way that we treat the people around us. And it's really good. My quibble is I think there's part of the case that they deliberately don't want to get into. And I don't want to spoil that either, but everyone in it is really good. It's a serious work of high importance, and it's very entertaining, and I loved it.
There's literally blood coming out of my mouth because I'm biting my tongue so hard from just unleashing a series of eras. Because you're talking about Chappaquiddick, and I'm dying.
Here's a measure of how great the film was. Earlier, before we hit record, I told you that Ed Helms is so good, you forget Andy Bernard on The Office. You don't think of it. Not once during the film did it ever occur to me to
How
do
is that
era.
Possible? I just rewatched The Departed and the whole movie. I'm just thinking about going.
No, and clearly,
not so much era as fucking. When I watched The Departed.
I don't know about you, but based on the podcast and writing columns, and if you're writing a column, and when you're writing about movies, you tend to use that three-letter word a lot. In my house, whenever anyone says it, mania.
Yeah.
That's how good Chappaquiddick is. It will let you leave that behind for 2 hours.
Oh, I don't know if I can, because the whole time I'm just going to be thinking about it.
Well, now. folks, you just heard me ruin Chappaquiddick for Patrick. If it's in your town, you really owe it to yourself to go. It's very, very good.
All right. Cool. I mentioned rewatching The Departed already. That movie holds up. That's all I'll say about that. There were only maybe two more that I wanted to talk about briefly. One was Death Wish, so that's done. There is a film, and I wasn't going to talk about it, but I am going to talk about it. I have this rule where, like, if I watch an indie horror film that I don't especially like, I generally will keep that to myself, right? And yet, there is a new label called Dread Central Presents, and it's a partnership with Epic Pictures, and it is run and curated by our friend Rob Galuzzo from Shockwaves. And not the first movies that they're putting out, but their first Blu-ray release is for this movie called Terrifier,
about
a killer clown, Art the Clown, who apparently has appeared in some other films as well.
So the film is also about the role of art in society.
Now, this was a film that was picked up before our friend Rob Galuzzo began his job at Dread Central Presents. So he shares no responsibility in unleashing this movie on the world. And thank goodness that they hired Mr. Rob Galuzzo to run Dread Central Presents, because if they hadn't, I think this is the movie that Dread Central would be putting out,
right,
based on their brand, based on other things I've seen from them. It is so, so mean-spirited. It really angered me, and I came very, very close to shutting it off at a certain point, which I generally don't do.
No.
I'm big on seeing things through, but it does something.
We started this, by gum.
It does something to an actress that I like, that is so, so unspeakably awful that it filled me with rage. So if you are seeing these Dread Central Presents titles, you can go ahead and skip Terrifier, unless that's the horror you're into. If you're just about, it's extreme, man. It's super gory.
Oh,
that clown is fucked up. Great. That's not my horror.
So it's called Terrifier.
Correct.
But I will now call it forever Art the Clown.
Sure. Go ahead.
And if I wanted to see Art the Clown, Is it streaming?
No.
It's a Blu-ray. It's
correct.
A physical object.
Correct. You would have to borrow it from me, which I bought because I wanted to support our friend Rob Galuzzo in his new venture.
And I
own fucking Terrifier.
I would borrow it from you, but life is too short.
Do not. And then the last movie I will talk about is last week I was talking about the Hollywood New Wave of the 1970s to my film class, trying to get them interested in it, trying to get them excited about it. Last semester when we did this, I showed a lot of A Decade Under the Influence.
Yeah.
And they didn't care, and they didn't know who the people were.
Wow.
And they didn't understand their significance, and even the clips from the movies didn't make them want to watch the movies, which I watched that documentary, and all I want to do is watch all those movies. So I only showed a clip this time. And this class is much better because they really responded. There's a lengthy clip from Dog Day Afternoon, and they really responded to it. So now I'm thinking about showing them all of Dog Day Afternoon. But I've specifically chose the clip where they're talking about the new style of actor who became famous in the 1970s. And because there's a talking head of Bruce Dern where he talks about how we wanted to be in there auditioning for the parts that Newman and Brando were getting. Because I forget the exact wording. It's like, we may not be as good looking as them, and there's a pause, but we're fucking interesting. And it's the greatest quote ever, and my class laughed, and I so applauded them for it. And then I showed them The French Connection, which I hadn't seen in a long time. And it's one of those movies, and we talked about this, I think, on the Alien podcast, where it's harder to appreciate now without a sense of history. So I feel like this group of students who are watching it for the first time, not understanding where it is placed, couldn't really appreciate how amazing it is. And I was trying to articulate that to them. Like, you guys don't understand. In 1970, you were seeing one kind of movie. And then this came along, and it's a pretty straightforward story about cops trying to get some bad guys. But the way that Friedkin tells it is like nothing that had ever been done. It blew people's minds, and I don't think they're quite wrapping their head around it. And that's what I'm trying to communicate, but holy shit, that movie.
Two or three years ago, that was the TCM Fathom event.
Yeah.
And Jan and I went to see it in a theater, and because of course I lived through that, but now I'm watching it, I'm comparing it to contemporary films. The amount of credit he gives the audience for the first 20 minutes, he's convinced that if he can keep it interesting in various ways, you'll keep watching, because the first 20 minutes of that film are almost incomprehensible until you start to put it together. And then, of course, he goes crazy with that. And in Sorcerer, I think it's the first 45 minutes where you're like, what is going on?
So, and unfortunately, Sorcerer is like, I think is a bridge too far. Do you see what I did? For this group,
And I'm not suggesting you show it to them, but French Connection, almost there was a time in the 80s where it was shown too much in film classes.
Okay.
And I think maybe for the wrong reasons, that it was fun to deconstruct the car chase.
Okay.
And that's what it became famous for. And that's certainly one reason why the film is a great film. I mean, it's one of the greatest car chases ever filmed. But there's so much going on in the film. The nature of the performances, the moral ambiguity of the ending.
Well, and that's
the first
what I,
20 minutes. Oh, what was their reaction to that?
The ending?
Yeah.
I just had to say, like, okay, that's every movie in the 1970s. Like, you're watching this thing, and then, boom, you're punched in the stomach. Credits.
Every movie from the time that you're talking about, the column today about Serpico, I think it was my son who weighed in and said, this is why the 70s is my favorite period of, of filmmaking, that for a certain period of time, all too short in the 70s, every film could have ended with a smash cut to the director on screen saying, So what do you think? Cut to black. Right. Because it was left in your lap.
Right.
But how liberating that the artist is saying, yeah. No, it's up to you. It's up to you to discern what's
right.
I mean, that's one of the greatest endings ever.
It's something.
We're not quite sure where anyone is, and we hear a gunshot.
Right.
And that's
yeah.
It's the greatest ending ever.
Yeah.
And sure, to really annoy people who like things to be a little bit more sewn up.
Let's talk about Vacation.
Okay, here's my thesis about Vacation.
Let's have it.
And we're going to show it. I'm sorry. You're going to show
yeah.
it tomorrow night.
But really, the royal we.
Maybe. I consider myself a king of my own castle. Is that National Lampoon's Vacation is half a good movie.
Oh, I will disagree.
Okay. I'm interested to hear you.
All right.
I discovered online, and anyone listening to this can Google John Hughes Vacation 58, and it's available at like 10 different websites.
Well, I think it was the Hollywood Reporter
yeah.
first kind of got the rights to reprint
That's
it.
That's the one I read.
When that sequel/remake/garbage movie, mm-hmm. Which is crazy that you say Ed Helms is so good in Chappaquiddick, because he has become someone who I liked, you know, for the first season of The Office when he was Andy Bernard, because I was like, oh, he found a way to play sort of the villain of the show in a way that's totally different from Rainn Wilson, and yet they're both playing these people you hate being around. But now when he shows up in trailers, it's like, oh, I don't want to see this
well,
comedy.
Well, that Christmas movie that he made about right. finding your dad.
And now the Tag movie. Oh, God. Right. I mean, the movie looks bad no matter what, but when Ed Helms shows up, I'm like, oh, you completely lost me now.
So when National Lampoon published Vacation 58,
yep.
I believe, and here's an example of my mind playing tricks with me, because I still can't believe how old I was when I went to see Annie Hall. And I tricked myself into thinking I didn't really get into the National Lampoon till I was in college. But the dates don't work out. So at the time that National Lampoon published Vacation 58, which I urge all of our listeners to go online and read, I had to be in high school, and I thought it was one of the funniest things I had ever read.
Okay.
Reading it this week to prepare yeah. for the podcast,
yeah.
I no longer think that.
No.
It doesn't hold up, but I think it's really interesting, especially in terms of seeing what from the short story he used in the movie and what sort of hit the curve.
And I wonder, because this is a movie that I know very, very well, and so certainly my reading of the story was colored by that, because certain things would happen that I would say, like, oh, I know this from the film. So I don't have the experience of reading it for the first time totally cold, right? I thought, in terms of the story, which again was written by John Hughes, if we haven't said right. this, and that's important to know.
And it was his entree to National Lampoon,
right.
which I didn't remember because I thought he had been writing for the magazine for a while. No, that was his calling card.
And then Vacation becomes his first screenplay,
right?
Which is a big deal as well. So I'm reading this short story, and the first third of the short story isn't funny, but it gets certain things right about everything going wrong. You're trying to get out of the house, and there's all these things that go wrong. And then for much of it, I was like, why did this become successful? And by the end, it has gotten weird and dark enough
yeah.
that I got it. I understood why it was a big deal at the time. But yeah, I agree. It doesn't.
And I will give it credit for this. It has one of the greatest opening sentences in the history of short stories. I took the liberty of writing it down.
It was the best of time.
If Dad hadn't shot Walt Disney in the leg, it would have been the best vacation ever. But clearly, that's John Hughes, the advertising copywriter.
Correct.
Coming up with something that really makes you want to read it. Because if you
think
about it,
it's in total disagreement with the rest of the story.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The entire vacation is a nightmare.
Correct.
Why would the narrator? But I also thought it was interesting that the short story is narrated by the son.
Right.
As is Christmas 59, which is sort of the sequel to that. And that really gets changed in the movie, because clearly in the movie, the focus is on Chevy Chase. And this is interesting to me, because I think one of the things I responded to when I was in high school and I read the story is that in the short story, the father is something of an angry cipher.
It's a Christmas story. its dad is this unknown quantity to be feared and to not upset.
And certainly that was my father, so I think that was my inroad. I don't quite understand this angry, angry fellow. But I will say this. You could see the structure of Vacation, the movie, leading up to Chevy Chase's obscenity-laden outburst. I think you're fucked in the head.
Mm-hmm.
We're this close and you want to bail. And then that clearly becomes the template for Christmas Vacation,
right,
where his outburst is now famous for just being the ravings of a madman where Christmas has gone short. But I also thought it was interesting that John Hughes, for the most part, gets very, very famous making these films about teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
And his first short story is from the perspective of a young person, and then the movie, of course, is flipped around so that it's more about the adults. Also, in the short story, it's the mother's desire to drive instead of...
And again, I would argue, and maybe this is because I am such a fan of this movie, and I will fully admit that a lot of it has to do with I kind of grew up on this movie. I saw it way too many times as a kid, which I shouldn't have. Obviously, this is a rated R comedy, although it, you know, minus a few things.
Oh, no, and that's the other thing, the thing about it being half of a good movie, that as time goes on and it becomes this brand, I think people tend to forget, and I think you're going to see this tomorrow night at the Elk Grove, that people tend to forget that this is an R-rated film, and that those parts that are R-rated are sort of jarring. Because our memory tells us that
this is the family comedy. So I watch it a lot of times, so I know that this is partly nostalgia goggles. I know that. But of all of the sort of the class of those early 80s comedies that people constantly name check, we already mentioned Caddyshack or Stripes or there's another one that's constantly being brought up. Of all of those, Vacation is my favorite. And I think that the decision to pivot it to being Clark's story and told through his perspective is key to making the movie work. I think if it's told by Anthony Michael Hall in the back seat, this movie doesn't work.
Well, and it also becomes a Christmas story out west in a very real way. No. I agree that Chevy Chase is one of the things in the movie that works.
And not just his performance, but the point of view of impossibly optimistic dad.
And that might have been, actually, this is the first time I'm thinking of this, but that might have been really a stroke of genius on John Hughes' part, that unless we're invested in the Chevy Chase character, things he, in the short story...
I don't think that comes from Hughes. I think this comes from Harold Ramis.
That in the short story, the father does some despicable things.
Right.
In the movie, Chevy Chase does some
Lots of really despicable
things.
Yeah.
But because it's in the service of this, I want to give my family a vacation.
And every time I've watched it, I've had the same reaction, which is funny. Because, again, even as a kid, I understood that, like, while Dark, the dog scene and the Aunt Edna stuff was funny, I understood black comedy as a very small child, right? Even rewatching it today, I feel like the scene that really does shift the audience sympathies is when he sort of cheats on Beverly D'Angelo in the pool. And I was like, well, that's fascinating. He's already done the stuff with Aunt Edna. He killed the dog. He's stolen from the place. And yet that's where we as an audience, I feel, turn on Clark Griswold because he has violated this little unit.
Yes. And the whole film is in defense of and trying to get the unit to Wally World. The whole thing with Christie Brinkley I thought was interesting, and I don't often engage in this. I'm going to improve the film. But the film goes nine-tenths of the way there. My problem with the Christie Brinkley story arc is that, number one, if I was married to Beverly D'Angelo...
Thank you for leading with this.
I call this the D. Wallace syndrome. One of the first conventions I ever went to, D. Wallace was one of the guests. And I was talking to her about 10. She's in the movie 10. And I said, I can't be the first person to say, Dudley Moore takes her home one evening at that place. And why on earth would you want Bo Derek if you've managed to woo Dee Wallace? And Dee Wallace said, I cannot tell you how many people have said that.
Of course.
That. Of course. Beverly D'Angelo, good Lord.
I feel like something chemically changed in me as a human being, like even as a kid with Beverly D'Angelo. Whatever.
She's really good, and I don't think she's served very well by the film. Because except when she's singing in the car, and that's delightful.
It is.
She's very much set up as a kind of a straight woman or a secondary character. But watching it again, I don't understand why she forgives him so quickly.
No, that is very false.
It's very,
very
strange.
Very false.
So go with me on this for 10 seconds.
Yeah.
Because the film's almost there. What if Christy Brinkley doesn't exist? And think of the first scene where Chevy Chase is driving and she suddenly appears next to him in that sports car. And then later at the truck stop or wherever they stop for the picnic, she's there. Right. But there's some truckers admiring her car, so it's real. What if throughout the entire film, Christy Brinkley was a mirage?
Does it make it a better movie? There's almost no payoff anyway.
But then, because there's no payoff anyway, that gets rid of you despising him in that scene. Because
there's
a way to spring that trap of that joke. Again, this is crazy speculation.
But the whole subplot is sort of weirdly unnecessary because I think it's trying to set up this midlife crisis that I don't think is what is informing the rest of his character.
No.
I don't think this pilgrimage to Wally World is informed by a midlife crisis that he's experiencing.
And then for some reason, they bring it back in Toto in Christmas Vacation,
yes,
with him flirting with the lingerie salesman. He has almost the exact same conversation with Rusty.
Right.
Will Mom buy it? And then later she's the fantasy at the pool. It's very strange.
Do you know the original payoff to Christy Brinkley?
No.
You know that the whole ending of this movie was reshot?
Yes, I do know that. For the better.
100%.
Oh, yeah.
So for those of you listening, the film originally ends with
the family going to Walt Disney's house.
They get to the park. Wally World is closed. They go to Roy Wally's house and hold him at gunpoint.
Which is in the short story.
Right. Make him entertain them. And the reason he doesn't press charges is because his daughter intervenes. And guess who his daughter is?
And that would have just been...
And rightfully, test audiences are like, what is this? You guys need to go to Wally World. We've spent 90 minutes trying to get to Wally World.
Right.
And so they go back and reshoot all the Wally World stuff and pay John Candy $1 million to show up and fucking steal the movie.
Because he's great in it. And that starts his collaboration with John Hughes. And the two became very, very good friends.
Right.
But I think whoever said it, and on the commentary, Doremus says it was him. You can't go 90 minutes.
Right.
We're trying to go here and then not go here.
I don't disagree that Beverly D'Angelo is underserved in terms of playing sort of the template for every sitcom where it's like dad's a buffoon and mom is rolling her eyes. And at the same time, I think she does say a lot of things. I think she has a lot of deliveries that are funny. I think they don't overplay she's so much smarter and so annoyed with him.
And she helps sell something that makes the whole movie work. In all of the vacation movies, we never doubt that they're in love.
No. And we don't doubt even that they're a family. Their chemistry is so great. I think they're all funny in really different ways. I think I appreciated Anthony Michael Hall on this viewing more than I ever have. Dana Barron does her best, whatever.
Yeah.
She was older and was supposed to be the older sister the entire movie. Every time I've ever watched this, I assumed Audrey was the younger one. She's the older sister.
Oh.
And then they had to change it when they reshot the ending because Anthony Michael Hall had gotten so much taller.
Oh, wow.
During those 5 months off that they said, I guess Rusty's the older one. And so that's how
we can take care of that in the looping.
But that sort of informs all the drug stuff.
Yeah.
That she's the older sister. That makes a little more sense with all the marijuana stuff.
So I made a list.
All right.
Of what works and what doesn't work.
Okay.
And I want you to talk me out of the stuff that doesn't work.
I may not, because I agree there's stuff that doesn't work.
I think we're in agreement about most of these things.
Yes.
Watching it again, The opening and closing credits are delightful.
They're great.
And now I'm Grandpa on the porch because movies no longer have opening credits because
right.
they're very afraid right. that unless you get... And maybe that's for TV because I paid the money and I'm in the theater. What do you think?
Well, and TV's even getting worse because now you watch a show on Netflix and they're like, do you want to skip this? We don't want to bother you for these extra 20 seconds.
Intro.
Right, where you might hear the theme song.
And Harold Ramis claims that it was his idea because he had a friend who had a vintage postcard collection and it was his hobby to photograph these crocodile motels and things along Route 66. And a lot of the postcards are mocked up. They're not real, but they're based on this guy's photograph. It's a delightful opening credit sequence
yeah.
with a song that we both love.
Yeah.
But also the idea that the end credits could be photographs, which, of course, we never see anyone take.
And one of the shots in that montage is them on the plane, which is speculated that that comes from that deleted ending. Because
which,
that's closer to the short story where they fly home.
Well, they all fly
dad's
home
in jail.
Except Dad.
Right.
But, and they're wearing Marty Moose hats.
Right.
Which, I don't know.
But supposedly footage of this does not exist. Chevy Chase claims to have a copy with the original ending, but it's never been released. It's not available anywhere.
So the opening and closing credits are great. The whole thing with Chase and the family, like you said, we never doubt.
Nope.
It's very convincing yep. that this is a family.
And he has a different relationship with Rusty than he has with Audrey.
Very definitely.
His scenes with Rusty are so funny. Anyway, their dynamic is great.
I love the scene where they share the beer.
Yeah.
And Anthony Michael Hall is really drinking the beer. That struck me as very realistic. Imogene Coca is so funny in this movie,
mm-hmm.
and she almost didn't take the part
mm-hmm.
because she said her reputation was as this nice person. But you've seen sketches from your show of shows.
Yeah.
I don't think Imogene Coca gets, I mean, it's all Lucy, Lucy, Lucy.
Right, right, right.
If you watch the stuff she did with Sid Caesar, it's amazing to watch. And she's so funny in this movie, just being the most disagreeable. And I would argue that because she does succeed, am I going to eat or am I going to starve to death? That helps sell
of course.
The dog thing and certainly helps sell.
Not as much the dog thing, but definitely the
yeah.
tying her to the roof of the car and leaving her.
Well, they left her with an umbrella. So every time I watch that scene, I think about Norm getting home and it's his mom
right?
and how you would react. Again, a great idea to do the reshoots because we actually want to see Wally World and the whole thing with John Candy, the voice he comes up with.
Right, which was a character sort of that he had played on SCTV.
Oh, yeah, I'm trying to remember.
Somebody like punch in the face or I can't remember the...
Paul Fist in your face.
There it is.
Okay. Candy played so many characters they get them confused. The whole thing with the dog is so dark and so awful.
So dark.
And I read, this might have been the internet article that was actually the commentary track repurposed, that Ramis let James Keach and Chevy Chase improvise.
Right.
And
they're both
if you watch
close
it
to
real
laughing.
Carefully, Chase hides it that he's pretending to be close to tears
right.
to con the cop.
Right.
But if you look at how it's edited, there's two shots where it's clear they went right to the frame where James Keach lost it.
And again, when you read the story, they talk about like the dog's carcass, and it's like, what? No, just the leash is enough.
And they did keep one line, although they toned it down. From the look of his foot pads...
Up a little much.
He kept up with you for about a mile and a half.
Probably the kept foot, up for about a mile or so.
The foot pad thing is gone because it's
so dark.
Horribly horribly nasty.
And even Chevy Chase, I know this movie so well, even his reaction, oh gosh, oh. Sorry.
The East St. Louis stuff doesn't work anymore, and I wonder, because it was a different time, Ramis disavows it on the commentary.
Well,
track.
Okay. So,
he said, I would not do it that way anymore. Back then, National Lampoon had a different standard for... I mean, think of the scene in Animal House where they go to the roadhouse.
Right.
And Universal executives said, if we leave this in the film, there will be riots.
Yeah.
But I would argue, and maybe I'm wrong, and maybe I'm racist, that the roadhouse scene works, and it's funny.
Okay.
And the thing in East St. Louis is so... It's the first R-rated language, which I thought they did on purpose. It's really jarring.
Fuck your mama.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it...
It, I agree.
It's just, there's no twist. It's just so diagrammatic.
It's racist in 1983, but more commonplace. And so I think audiences weren't as put off by it in 2018. It's remarkably tone deaf. It was very interesting. I did not listen to the commentary, but on the Blu-ray, there's like this 90-minute retrospective with everybody who's in the movie, except for John Candy.
It's like a featurette?
It's 90 minutes. I mean, it's – and that Ramis and Matty Simmons and everyone in
the
cast.
Could there be another Blu-ray that doesn't have that?
Maybe.
Or is it hard to find on the menu? I looked for something like that.
I don't think so.
There's this weird 90-second introduction from Matty Simmons, Chevy Chase.
Yeah, I didn't watch that. But
and then there's the commentary track.
Right.
And there's the featurette.
90-minute – anyway, a lot of it is spent on Christy Brinkley. Dana Barron is still – such a babe. But yeah, so everybody's in it, and it's fascinating to watch because they bring it up, and then you watch everyone in the cast sort of, not just the cast, everyone involved with the making of the film tap dance around it and suggest, well, it's not racist, it's a commentary on racism. And it's, the joke is on the Griswolds, because they're the bad people in the scene, and none of what they're saying.
So we're not stealing the Psycho score. It's an homage to the Psycho score.
It was uncomfortable to watch them all try to suggest that it's okay. Just be Ramis and cop to it and say, like, you know, it was 1983 and we should have known better and didn't.
And here's the interesting thing about that sequence. I once went on a vacation. I took my family on a vacation to a theme park, to Cedar Point. And then we kept going, and we went to Cleveland to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I'm not making this up. We took the wrong exit for the hotel, and we wound up in a neighborhood. And it was just like the scene in National Lampoon's Vacation, except if you're really in this place with a lot of economically disadvantaged people – there's all sorts of different people. It isn't just black.
Right.
But as we're driving, and it's like midnight, we got in late, all the children were up and running around and playing. And it was like a movie. We're driving, and it's like, those kids are like eight. What are those kids doing up? And this is before the internet, or not, I certainly can't access the internet from the car. So I called the hotel for directions, because I got off the main road.
And the person on the other end said, what do I look like, Christopher Columbo?
No. Here's what happened. This could have been in the movie. He said, where are you? And I gave him the cross streets. And he said, don't be scared. I'm going to get you to the hotel. So we were in what you would call a bad neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But no one stole my hubcaps.
No.
And it...
And again, the big problem...
And I know, it's a crazy comedy. It just, especially considering what the rest of the film is like, that comes off as tone deaf.
Very much so. And I think there's a big difference between saying the scene is funny because they're in a bad neighborhood and saying the scene is funny because they're in a black neighborhood. And unfortunately, with the exception of the one security guard who... They made me act like a dog, Mr. Wally.
Yeah.
These are the only black people we see in the movie. And
the
so
Frank
there
McCray
is...
character does not help the film's claim.
Exactly. So there is such a sense of otherness to that scene. And had perhaps it been a more diverse film, and again, this is 1983, and unfortunately that was not happening very much, it might not come off as badly, because at least we could say, well, it's just a bad part of town. But again, it might have helped if it wasn't only black people. You could have had also white people in the bad part of town.
I will argue that sequence has one funny line when Mr. Directions says that he's from Chicago. He's on vacation.
In the story, they're Native Americans who rob them.
Yes.
Which is fascinating. Just a different kind of racism. And we decided to update it for the movie.
That's later repurposed for the thing where at this stage, but they're
helpful Native Americans.
Well, they're still robbed and they're still the sheriff joke.
Oh, right.
But that John Hughes finds white trash.
Right.
Very interesting because you have the whole
Eddie. Now we're at Cousin Eddie, right, which, again, for me as a kid was like some of the funniest stuff in the movie, and I will admit that there is some of that rings true for me because we had some family in rural Missouri, and some of that was similar to experiences that I had.
And your cousin said that her father was the best at French kissing.
And guess what? She was right. But yeah, watching it today, I mean, John Hughes has always had, you know, kind of issues about class.
And watching it again, I thought that this was the blueprint for Randy Quaid's Eddie character, but that Eddie doesn't reach full fruition until Christmas Vacation,
right,
where he's just... I think he's a lot funnier in Christmas Vacation than in National Lampoon's Vacation. Shitter's full.
I think he's less of a cartoon in this Vacation.
Yeah.
I just think, like, jokes like, who plays his wife? Mr. Mom, right? You're doing it wrong, but I can't. When she says something like, Eddie says, I can quit, you know, one of my extra jobs, and I guess we're supposed to laugh, but, like, what the fuck is that?
Well, also, they're only letting the aunt stay with them for her Social Security checks.
Which, that's fine, because I think there's truth there in terms of family who is nice to family for selfish reasons.
Okay.
I don't think that rings false, but I just thought some of that it's a joke that she's working these extra jobs just to make ends meet is like, go fuck yourself. And this is actually coming up at an interesting time because just this week, did you read the thing that Molly Ringwald wrote? It was kind of all over social media. She wrote a thing about sort of revisiting the Breakfast Club post Time's Up.
I saw it, but I didn't click on it because I may be way off on this. Wasn't there a time when Molly Ringwald suggested that her relationship with John Hughes may have been bad and exploitative?
Yeah, and I think she still thinks that. It's interesting. I think it's very much worth reading, and unfortunately I saw some shitheads on Twitter who maybe didn't read the piece or just have issues with nuance. One person said, like, yeah, well, it's always been problematic, so good for you. Like, okay, read the piece. And somebody else said, he gave you a career. I believe what you're looking for is thank you. And it's like, oh my God. And throughout the piece.
Because it's either one or the other.
Right. Throughout the piece, she's saying, he gave me my break. He made me a movie star. At the same time, he could be cruel and manipulative. And he turned on me at a certain point because he didn't like, I don't know, that she didn't love him back. Like she has said, I believe I was his muse. Anyway. It's a very interesting, nuanced look at, hey, some of this stuff is problematic, but we can still talk about it. And, some of it hasn't aged well. And I had that in mind as I was watching certain things in Vacation because, yeah, some of this stuff is like, bleh. But at the same time, like, I still think it's a good, funny movie.
Right. Because especially when it came out, none of us had any of this in our heads.
Right.
And Daddy Says I'm the Best at French Kissing was a white trash joke, and that's it.
Right.
The whole thing with him showing them the vacation on the home computer and it becoming Pac-Man, which, to be fair to your girlfriend, Dana Barron, on the commentary track, the minute the scene starts, she pipes up, and she's not on the commentary very much. Okay, this is what dates the film.
It's ridiculous. I mean, the whole thing about the computer, and even as a kid, I was like, well, this isn't how computers work. You can't just introduce your video game into what he's doing. But I don't care because I just, the way that Chevy Chase says stuff like, Russ, please don't eat the family truckster. Thank you, Audrey.
Yeah, I like when he thanks her for shooting.
It's so matter of fact, and I just think it's so funny.
And I already talked about Christy Brinkley. Is part of your love of this film nostalgia goggles?
It may very well be. Because again, watching it today, it was like, I remember all of these lines. And obviously it's super episodic, but I think most of the episodes are pretty funny. I think the performances are all really strong. And I think it finds ways to be funny that aren't just, hey, we tied a dead woman to the top of the car.
Oh, no, no, no. I agree with that, that you have...
So much of it is just character.
Exactly. You have the structure from the short story, and you have a script that adds a lot to it. But certainly what Ramis is bringing to the party and then the performances, it's a multi-level cake.
He adds some warmth to it and some humanity. And just Harold Ramis understands comedy in a way that few filmmakers have ever understood comedy, I think, and just understands how jokes are structured and how to layer them in and how to just add a lot of jokes and not in the airplane way.
Yeah.
Because again, these are all rooted in character, but even Eugene Levy's 5-minute scene is filled with so many great little jokes. If you think you hate it now, where do you drive it?
That scene comes across as a self-contained SCTV skit.
Sure.
But that's very much Ramis and Levy.
Right. And that's kind of... And it's interesting because, again, watching the that documentary feature, which maybe ran on TV. I feel like A&E or somebody used to run these...
Oh, right. And when you watch
I watched one on Halloween.
When you watch them on cable, there's so many commercials. But when it shows up as a special feature, it's like, oh, I can watch this without the commercial.
But it's also
backstory.
Okay, but the structure is sort of built in to it because there's the little pre-commercial tease. And then there's no fade to black or anything, but all of a sudden they're repeating something that you just saw a minute and a half ago. And you're like, oh, because there would have been commercials and now they're catching us
What's
up.
What's on the cover of your Blu-ray?
Chevy Chase?
Just a picture of him?
I think so.
So either we have a different disc,
okay,
or I could not find
Perhaps.
It on the menu,
yeah,
which I'm sure it's the latter.
They were talking about Chevy Chase and how different this was for him because...
He was the romantic lead.
Exactly. And I grew up, this was Chevy Chase to me because this was probably my introduction to him. So I never experienced him as
Seems
cool.
Seems like old times and foul play.
Right.
And...
Or even just him on SNL where the joke is, I'm smarter and better and cooler than you. To me, Chevy Chase was this massive dork. And I just think he's so good in this movie. And I said this at the beginning, just that I really think that the pivot to it being told through his eyes and his desire to give his family this dream vacation sells me on it so much. Even lines like or maybe you don't want to see the second largest ball of twine. I mean, and he's genuinely excited about it. It's
the thing
not...
about the mud house,
right,
in the short story gets repurposed, right. But the mud house does come up,
right.
I have a question for you, which I was trying to figure out upon my latest rewatch. In the Wild West town,
yes,
that's so touristy and awful, they are warned that the bartender is crusty, and then Chase deliberately provokes the man.
Right.
And the man takes out a shotgun and shoots it. But the way it's shot, Chevy Chase does a pratfall,
yeah,
gets up, he's fine.
Yeah.
We don't see the shotgun destroying anything.
No.
So... Is the conceit that the crusty bartender has blanks in the shotgun?
Well, yeah, I guess.
And Chase is in on it's not explained.
He wasn't in on it. I think when he got shot, he thought he got shot and then realized he hadn't gotten shot because then his demeanor completely changes when he says, excuse me, bartender, you know, like he becomes nice guy because he realized, okay, like, oh, I pushed this too far.
It's very strange.
It is very strange. And again, there are scenes, the scene where he pins Beverly D'Angelo's head under the steering wheel,
yeah,
is, you know, gross. But then she has a great line like, you're tired, you get weird when you're tired. And I've always loved, you get weird when you're tired.
I'm also thinking about the sequence where he robs the cash register, the old-timey Western cash register.
Yes.
And how that is made more palatable because the front desk clerk is being...
And he puts the check in there.
Yeah.
So again, there's all these things that happen that they just sort of try to make you okay with.
Because in the short story, not only does he authentically rob them,
right,
but there's a police chase.
Correct.
That the father, he gets away.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's why the Christie Brinkley thing in the pool, they don't make that palatable. And the way that they try to do it is by having Beverly D'Angelo immediately forgive him and then jump in the pool and yell cold. And like, it's fine, whatever. But I agree that a lot of that stuff rings false. But I don't care.
I'm wondering really why, like, considering the film that they wound up making, they thought that Beverly D'Angelo had to be nude.
I don't know.
I mean, it's odd.
She apparently had no problem with it. Again, they tell a story on this documentary where the day that she was there to shoot the shower scene, she disrobed, they said, about 30 feet from the shower. And they said, well, you could get closer. And then she said, you know what? I did hair for 3 years. This is nothing. But it is interesting, as somebody who grew up watching this on TV, right, there is less nudity on the Blu-ray. Because it's cropped properly in widescreen.
And the minute he does the psycho thing, the cut to the other angle seems to me to be TV safe.
Right.
Where we can cut this together. Watching Reanimator, believe it or not, last week, I was seeing how there were some sequences where, I don't know if this went into Stuart Gordon's thinking, that you can see how this can be done on TV to not show the nudity.
There's no way Reanimator ever showed on TV. How?
Oh, I know how.
How?
I know how. I know the answer to this.
Okay.
It's in the documentary, which I was able to access on that disc. they shot a whole bunch of material.
Oh, that's right.
Where Dr. Hill can affect your mind. That, in fact, from the beginning of the film, originally, he had the dean under some sort of hypnotic spell. So they took out all the bad stuff, and now it's a half an hour long. So they put that back. It's like the Halloween thing.
Right. So there's,
we have to get it up to
the integral cut incorporates everything,
yeah,
right? Okay. And I have not yet watched the integral cut.
Well, because as Stuart Gordon says on one of the numerous commentary tracks that he's done, you didn't need it. Considering the film that you're watching, even with that stuff gone, you say, oh, Dr. Hill's communicating with these corpses somehow. Okay.
Right.
It's not
also dead people have been brought back to life.
Yeah,
like that is
I'm in for a penny, I'm in for a pound.
Right,
I'm with you so far.
Exactly.
Be my guest. There's telepathy. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm a big, big fan of this movie.
I'm a big, big fan of half of this movie. But I'm glad, because I think very often on the podcast we agree a lot.
Sure.
Because in the spirit of Dr. Hill, I hypnotized you when you were in high school. You will.
But it's not
like
just it's not like a first half, second half thing for you.
Oh,
it's
no.
This scene works, this scene doesn't, this
right.
episode works. It was interesting to think about them shooting it, because again, I never really had given that any thought, especially watching it as a kid, that yeah, they had 30 giant trucks traveling across the United States shooting this movie. I just never really gave
virtually,
much thought.
Virtually in order from what
right,
I've read.
Right.
And
remapped the route that John Hughes had them traveling through the South, and Harold Ramis said, well, no, we need to go through all of these touristy
right.
places. So they sent the location manager on the trip to find all the places. Because again, Harold Ramis is a genius and I miss him so much.
And another piece of trivia, during the Chariots of Fire run through the parking lot, because you have to park in the back of the parking lot, so at the end of the day you're first.
Which is such a dad detail,
oh,
though, right?
God.
I mean,
I forget what parking lot they used, although I read in several places.
It was a racetrack.
Santa Anita.
Yeah.
It's 110 that day. And when you watch that sequence, knowing that, it's really obvious that it was crazy hot. And think about that. And how many times would they have had it? We need you to run through an empty asphalt parking
lot.
And
everybody is really sick and really scared on the roller coaster because they had to ride it so many times.
They had to do it over and over.
And John Candy was not supposed to be sitting next to Anthony Michael Hall. He was supposed to be next to Chevy Chase, but they wouldn't both fit. in the car, so they switched him out with Anthony Michael Hall, which I like a lot better.
Well, I love when Anthony Michael Hall reaches over and covers John right. Candy's mouth. That's delightful. And in a lot of those shots, Beverly D'Angelo's in the far back.
Yeah.
And sometimes it doesn't look like she knows they're filming.
A lot of times I don't think it was her. I think she said a stunt person did it a bunch of times, too.
Oh, okay. Because it's not in focus because we're focused on the first
one. Right.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm a big fan of this movie. It's one of my favorite 80s comedies.
If you're anywhere near Elk Grove, you need to come to this screening.
I would hope so. I think it'll be fun with a lot of people. And
it needs a big audience.
It does need a big audience. Anyway, thank you guys for listening. As always, we're on Twitter and Facebook and all those places. You can email us at fthismoviepodcast. I said email weird. You can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com.
You can email us or ameliorate us or
thanks.
Just hate us.
Thank you, Jay Bones. Doing this podcast is great preparation for me having to talk tomorrow, which is why you so thoughtfully suggested that perhaps we do it. So I appreciate it.
And it's another way for me to shoehorn myself into your already busy life.
Thank you guys for listening. We will see you next week.
We went dancing.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.